Welcome back to the Deep Dive. Today we're going to start by shattering an illusion.
Yeah, a pretty big one.
You know the one. We've all seen it in the movies a thousand times. The hacker in the hoodie, sitting in a dark room, furiously typing away.
Right, with the screens cascading with falling green code.
Exactly. And there's usually some pulsing techno music, big red access denied banners flashing everywhere, until they hit one final key and boom, access granted.
Very loud, very visual.
Very dramatic. But if the stack of reports on our desk today proves anything, it's that real modern cyber warfare isn't loud at all.
No, it's not. It is terrifyingly quiet.
And today we are unpacking a specific case study that illustrates just how dangerous that silence can be. We're looking at the massive breach of Singapore's digital infrastructure,
which has really just come to light here in February 2026.
And we should clarify for everyone listening, this isn't just another data leak. We aren't talking about someone stealing passwords from a streaming service or, you know, a retailer.
Far from it.
We are talking about a sophisticated, state-sponsored siege on one of the most technologically advanced nations on Earth.
It really was a siege.
And to set the stakes for you today, I want to start with a number from the forensic analysis. 280.
Right. 280 days, that is the dwell time.
Now, for listeners who might not be in the cybersecurity industry, could you define dwell time? Because it sounds a bit like a real estate term.
Yeah, it does sound like buying a condo. But no, dwell time is the clock that starts ticking the second a hacker breaches your network, and it stops the moment you actually find them.
Okay.
In the security world, the global average is somewhere around 20 days. And frankly, even that is considered a massive failure.
You want that to be minutes.
Minutes, not days.
But here we're talking about 280 days.
Nearly 10 months. Imagine someone living in your attic, they're eating your food, reading your mail, listening to your conversations for almost a year before you realize the floorboards are squeaking.
That is unsettling.
And remember, this is Singapore. They have some of the most sophisticated next-gen firewalls and endpoint detection systems money can buy.
Right. This wasn't a system that was left completely unguarded.
Not at all.
So that's the core mystery we need to solve in this deep dive. We are analyzing two key documents today from Tech and Analysis. One is a forensic breakdown titled Anatomy of the Breach.
And the other is a really fascinating technical report called the Ancient Protocol Catastrophe.
Our mission is to figure out how groups identified in the reports as APT-41 and Volt Typhoon managed to camp out in a fortress like that for so long.
And more importantly, we're going to see that this wasn't a bank robbery. They weren't just stealing credit card numbers or trying to ransom data.
According to the analysis, this was a dress rehearsal for geopolitical warfare.
Exactly.
So let's get into the mechanics of it. The first term that really dominates the forensic report is living off the land.
Yes.
It sounds kind of rustic,
yeah.
Almost agricultural. But in this context, it's incredibly sinister.
It is. To understand living off the land, you really have to understand how traditional defense works.
Okay.
Usually you have what's called a castle and moat strategy. You have a firewall and you have antivirus software. The antivirus has a list of bad signatures.
Like known viruses, Trojans, that sort of thing.
Right. If a file tries to enter the network and it matches that bad list, it gets blocked.
So it's basically like a bouncer at a club checking a list of banned patrons.
That's a great way to put it. If your face is on a list, you don't get in.
Got it.
But living off the land, or LOTL, bypasses that entirely. The hackers don't bring their own malicious files.
They don't bring weapons with them.
No. They use the tools that are already installed on your system.
Okay, so to use a different analogy, if a burglar wants to rob a high-security office building, they don't pick the lock or break a window.
No. They steal a security guard's uniform, they take a legitimate key card, they just walk through the front door, wave at the receptionist, sit down at a computer, and use the company's own administrative software to steal the data to the security cameras, or in this case, the AI detection software. They look like they belong there.
That explains the why regarding the stealth, but let's talk about the how. The report breaks this down into phases.
Right.
Phase one was initial access. How did they get the guard's uniform in the first place?
Well, they exploited unpatched vulnerabilities in the edge devices, specifically legacy VPN gateways.
These were from vendors like Fortinet and PulseSecure, right?
Yes. These are the tunnels employees use to log in from home. They are the entry points to the DMZ, the demilitarized zone of the network.
Now, the report mentions end-day vulnerabilities here.
Yeah.
You usually hear about 0 days in the news, which are brand new. What exactly is an end-day?
So a 0 day is a flaw nobody knows about yet. The vendor hasn't fixed it.
Right.
An end day is a flaw that is known. A patch actually is available, but the IT administrator just hasn't applied it yet.
Oh, I see.
The hackers found the doors where the locks were broken, and the landlord just hadn't gotten around to fixing them.
That is frustrating. Okay, so they're inside the perimeter. Now, usually when you install a program on a server, it leaves a footprint.
Right, a file on the hard drive.
Something the forensics team can find later. But the report calls phase two the ghost.
This is fileless execution. And it's the primary reason the dwell time was 280 days. They didn't write anything to the hard disk at all.
Where did it go then?
They ran their code directly in the volatile memory, the RAM.
So the code is just floating in the temporary brain of the computer.
Exactly.
But doesn't RAM get flushed when you reboot the machine?
It does, and that's the brilliance of it. Evil brilliance, sure, but brilliance nonetheless.
Right.
If an IT admin suspects something is wrong and reboots the server to clear it out, the evidence vanishes instantly.
It's like writing your plans on a whiteboard and erasing them completely every time someone walks into the room.
That's exactly it.
But wait, if the code is gone, they lose their access, right? They'd have to break in all over again.
Not quite. They installed tiny hidden back doors in those edge devices we mentioned earlier.
Oh, so they left the window unlocked.
Right. They could just walk back in and reload the code into memory whenever they wanted. It made forensics analysis a total nightmare because there was nothing on the disk to analyze. The hard drives were perfectly clean.
That is wild. So once they are running in memory, they start phase three, which the report calls lateral movement.
Yes. They need to jump from the VPN gateway to the sensitive servers. And this goes back to your guard's uniform analogy.
How so?
They use tools like PowerShell and WMI, that's Windows Management Instrumentation.
Okay.
These are standard, legitimate tools that IT administrators use every single day to manage the network, check system health, or move files around.
So if the security system sees a PowerShell script running, it just thinks, oh, that's just Bob from IT doing his job.
Correct. The detection systems completely failed because they were looking for malware. They weren't looking for standard administrative traffic behaving slightly strangely.
They whitelisted the behavior because it looked routine.
Yes. Hiding in plain sight.
Okay, let's talk about the target. You mentioned earlier this wasn't about money. They didn't touch the customer credit card databases.
No, not at all. They went straight for the brain of the telecom network, the 5G core.
And specifically the HLR and HSS servers.
Yes.
We should probably define those for everyone because they sound like obscure technical components, but the report makes it clear they are the keys to the kingdom.
They really are. HLR stands for Home Location Register, and HSS is Home Subscriber Server.
Okay.
Think of this as the master list of every single SIM card, every identity, and the real-time location of every user on the network.
Wow.
If you control the HSS, you control the communication arteries of the entire country. You know who everyone is, and you know where everyone is.
That is a terrifying thought. It leads us perfectly into the next segment of the analysis, because I think a lot of us have this assumption that 5G is super secure.
Oh, absolutely.
We hear the marketing all the time. Mm-hmm. End-to-end encryption, cloud-native architecture. We're led to believe it's bulletproof.
Well, the Tekken Report actually calls that the biggest commercial lie in the industry.
Really?
And it's a lie that vendors Ericsson, Nokia, Huawei, all of them have been pretty content to let governments believe.
Why is it a lie, though? Is the encryption not working?
The encryption works perfectly fine between your phone and the cell tower. That part is secure.
Okay.
But the moment your call or your text message leaves that tower and needs to go somewhere else, say, to route a roaming call or send a bank verification code, the network has to talk to other networks.
Right.
And to do that, the report says it time travels.
Time travels? What does that mean?
It falls back on protocols from the 1980s.
Wait, you're saying our cutting-edge, ultra-fast 5G network is relying on tech from the disco era?
Literally. It relies on something called SS7, signaling system number 7. This was created in 1975.
1975. That's before the public internet even existed.
Exactly. And back then, there were only a few state-owned telecom monopolies. Everyone knew everyone.
Right. It was a very small club.
So the protocol was built on absolute trust. If a network said, hey, I'm a carrier in France, please route this call, the system didn't check ID.
It just let it through.
It just said, sure thing, friend.
Right.
It was a handshake deal built directly into the code.
And that absolute trust is exactly what the hackers exploited in the Singapore case.
Precisely. The report details how they infiltrated signaling hubs in third-party countries.
Places with weaker security standards.
Right. Then they use those hubs to spoof their identity. They basically put on a mask and said, "Hello, Singapore. We are a legitimate foreign operator. Please send us the data."
And because Singapore's system is built on that 1970s SS7 foundation, it just trusted the request.
It did.
What specifically could they do with that access once they had it?
Pretty much everything. They intercepted SMS two-factor authentication codes.
Two-factor codes?
Yes. Think about high-ranking financial executives, diplomats, government officials. They're trying to log into their secure accounts. The bank sends a text code, and the hackers get it in real time.
Which essentially renders two-factor authentication completely useless. If they have the code, they have the account.
And it gets worse than that. They used cell tower triangulation.
What's that?
They could track the physical movements of specific targets down to the street level, all without ever installing spyware on the victim's phone.
So they didn't even need to hack the device itself?
No, they didn't need to hack the phone. They hacked the network asking where the phone was.
That is incredibly targeted surveillance.
Yeah.
But the report also discusses something called BGP hijacking, which sounds much broader.
It is much broader. If SS7 is about targeted spying, BGP, which stands for Border Gateway Protocol, is about mass interception.
Okay.
BGP is essentially the GPS or the compass of the internet. It tells data how to get from country A to country B.
And this traffic is traveling via those massive submarine cables on the ocean floor, right?
Right. Specifically, the CME3 cable in this case. The hackers managed to poison the global routing tables.
Poisoning the tables. Walk us through what that actually looks like for the data.
Sure. So normally, traffic from Singapore to the U.S. might go directly across the Pacific or through safe, established hops.
Makes sense.
But the hackers changed the signposts. They made the routers believe that the absolute fastest way to get to the U.S. was through China telecom servers in Beijing.
A detour.
A massive detour. Traffic was siphoned from Singapore, routed all the way through Beijing, where it was inspected and copied, and then injected back into the original path.
And nobody noticed. Usually a detour that big would severely slow down your connection. You get buffering or noticeable lag.
That's the scary part. The latency, the delay caused by this detour was negligible. We're talking milliseconds.
Wow.
The attackers had optimized the route so efficiently that the user experience didn't change at all. It took threat hunters months to spot it.
How did they finally catch it?
They only found it by analyzing time to live, or TTL anomalies, in the data packets. It was a man-in-the-middle attack on a true geopolitical scale.
Which brings us to the big question. Why? Why go to all this trouble? The source material is pretty firm that this wasn't about extortion.
No, Tekken Analysis is very clear on this point. They dismiss the idea of a financial motive entirely.
So who do they blame?
The report attributes the attack to state-sponsored entities linked to the PLA, the People's Liberation Army, specifically Unit 61398.
So the sources are saying this is pure military strategy.
Yes. The report outlines three main objectives, and frankly, none of them are good news.
Let's go through them. Objective one is listed as cyber cartography for Taiwan.
Right. If you look at a map, Singapore is a crucial logistics and communications hub for the U.S. Pacific Fleet and NATO allies.
Okay.
If there is ever a kinetic conflict, a real shooting war over Taiwan, Singapore's infrastructure is vital. The report suggests the hackers were mapping the topology.
They wanted to know exactly which routers to hit to blind Western military communications in the region.
Exactly. They were building a target list, preparing the battlefield. They weren't firing shots yet. They were just calibrating the site.
That makes sense. But objective two moves well beyond just mapping. It involves something called logic bombs.
That sounds dramatic, I know.
It does.
Yeah.
What is a logic bomb in this context?
It's code. But the effect is entirely physical. They didn't just take data. They left something behind.
What did they leave?
They injected dormant malware into the firmware of critical equipment. Now, firmware is the software that runs the hardware itself. It's the deepest level of instruction a machine has.
And these bombs are just sitting there?
Yes. They are completely asleep. According to the analysis, they are waiting for a specific cryptographic signal, basically a wake-up call from Beijing.
And if that signal is sent?
The code executes and bricks the hardware instantly.
When you say brick, you mean it shuts down?
I mean it turns into a useless piece of plastic and metal. It wipes the core boot instructions.
So you can't just reboot it?
No, you can't just reinstall the operating system. You have to physically go to the data center, unscrew the rack, pull the hardware out, and replace it.
Wow. Imagine that happening to the entire core network of a country simultaneously.
That's a total blackout. That's days, maybe weeks, of complete silence.
Which leads us directly to Objective 3 from the report, the signaling storm.
Yes. This was essentially a drill, a cyber nuke, effectively.
How does that work?
The theory they were testing is if you send millions of fake attach requests, basically simulating millions of phones trying to connect to the network all at once to the HLR servers, can you overload them?
And what was the answer?
The answer was yes. They proved they could cause a total communications blackout in seconds.
This is incredibly heavy stuff. But the report actually makes a point to zoom out from Singapore here. Because if Singapore, with its massive cyber budget, its close ties to the NSA and GCHQ, couldn't stop this.
Who else is vulnerable? Right.
Exactly. And that brings us to the section on the Middle East. The report calls it the Middle East blast wave.
It does. And the source uses a very vivid term here to describe the vulnerability. Technological Frankenstein syndrome.
Frankenstein syndrome. That is quite the visual.
It's a perfect description, really. If you look at the networks in the Gulf states, you have massive budgets, rapid expansion. You have these incredible smart cities like Enome being built.
Right. Massive tech investments.
But under the hood, the networks are a hodgepodge.
A patchwork monster like Frankenstein.
Exactly. You have legacy 3G and 4G networks stitched together with brand new 5G.
Okay.
You have Western equipment from Ericsson or Nokia mixed right alongside Eastern hardware from Huawei or ZTE.
And I assume these different parts don't always play nice together.
They definitely don't. And that lack of cohesion creates massive gaps. The report calls them protocol translation layers.
What happens in those layers?
It's where the language of one machine has to be translated so another machine can understand it. And that translation point is exactly where security breaks down.
I see.
It's hard enough to secure a network that's completely uniform. Securing a Frankenstein network is a nightmare.
And the stakes in the Middle East aren't just about dropped calls or stolen emails either, are they?
No. Think about what runs on those networks. SCADA systems.
Which are the control systems for industrial equipment.
Right. Telemetry for oil refineries, desalination plants, the energy grids, the Internet of Things.
So if a hacker gets into the telecom network there, they aren't just intercepting text messages.
No, they could potentially send commands to physically shut down crude oil transfer pumps in the Persian Gulf.
That shifts the global energy market in minutes.
It's physical consequences resulting from digital actions. The report warns that without aggressive red teaming, which is basically attacking your own network to find the flaws before the bad guys do, these Middle Eastern operators are just glowing, moving targets.
So we've painted a pretty grim picture today. The invisible siege, the protocol flaws, the sleeping logic bombs. But the source material does offer a survival guide at the end. It's not all hopeless, right? We have to be able to fight back.
It's not hopeless, no. But it requires a radical change in mindset. The report's verdict is incredibly blunt. The era of castle and moat cybersecurity is completely dead.
We can't just build a big wall and assume we're perfectly safe inside.
No, you can't. The first solution they propose is zero trust architecture.
We hear that buzzword a lot in the industry. What does it actually mean in practice for you and me?
It means exactly what it says. Stop trusting the internal network. Just because a user or a device is inside the firewall doesn't mean they are a friend.
Okay.
Every single packet of data, every request, every user must be authenticated continuously.
So you're checking ID at every single door inside the building, not just the front gate.
Exactly. Even if you're the CEO, if you want to access the HR database, you have to prove it's you every single time.
Makes sense. Mm-hmm. Now, the second solution is AI NDR. AI-driven network detection and response.
Right. Fighting AI with AI.
You have to, right?
You do. Humans just can't scan petabytes of network traffic looking for a tiny anomaly. Traditional firewalls are totally blind to those living off the land attacks we talk about because the traffic looks completely legitimate.
Right. It looks like Bob from IT.
Exactly. You need AI hunters that constantly learn the baseline behavior of the network. They learn that Bob from IT usually runs his PowerShell scripts at 9 a.m., not 3 a.m.
Oh, I see.
So they spot the tiniest deviation, a microsecond anomaly in encrypted traffic, and flag it instantly.
And the third solution mentioned was microsegmentation.
This is all about containment. If HR gets hacked, say someone in payroll clicks a bad phishing link, it should be technically impossible for that hacker to jump across the network to the 5G core.
You chop the ship into airtight compartments.
Yes. So if one compartment floods, the whole ship doesn't sink.
That brings us to one final threat mentioned in the survival guide. It sounded almost like sci-fi to me, but apparently it is very real. Harvest now, decrypt later.
This is the quantum threat.
Right.
Hackers know that today's encryption is strong, they can't break it right now, but they also know that quantum computers are coming. Maybe in 5 years, maybe 10.
So they just steal the encrypted data now anyway.
And they store it, they harvest it, they keep it sitting on massive servers. And the day a quantum computer comes online that can crack that encryption, they just unlock all the secrets they stole a decade ago.
Talk about playing the long game, so what's the fix for that?
Investment in QKD, quantum key distribution.
Which is?
It's a new type of cryptography that uses the actual principles of quantum mechanics to secure data. It's very expensive, it's hard to implement, but the report says it's an absolute imperative for protecting national secrets. You have to encrypt today for the computers of tomorrow.
It really feels like we are fully in a new era. The report ends with a pretty stark statement about neutrality.
It does. It says, in 2026, there are no neutral countries on the digital map.
You are either armored or you cease to exist.
That's the reality. The battlefield has completely moved. It's not on the borders anymore. It's in the server rooms, it's in the undersea cables, and it's right there in the memory of the devices we use every single day.
It's a sobering thought. We started this deep dive talking about the illusion of Hollywood hacking. The noise, the music, the visuals.
Right.
But the reality? The silence of a 280-day siege is infinitely scarier.
It is. Because while we were all looking for the fallen green code on the screen, they were already inside, just holding the keys.
Before we wrap up, here is something to keep you up at night. The Tekken report confirmed the existence of logic bombs, those sleeping kill switches, in Singapore's firmware.
Yeah.
They found them. But it begs a massive question. If Singapore found theirs, how many other nations, how many power grids, how many communication hubs around the world currently have bricks sleeping in their infrastructure, just listening for a wake-up signal that hasn't been sent yet?
That is the ultimate question, and I'm afraid the answer isn't one we're going to like.
That's it for this deep dive. Stay curious, stay paranoid, and we'll see you next time.